Probably not a great deal, but we have one thing going for us. We're going to be 15 minutes shorter. That'll be a big accomplishment. But that'll be interesting. I think Senator Mondale is studying now, and I've been studying today and trying to shake off a cold, so we'll be prepared.
What major items do you plan to attack Mondale on?
Well, I don't have any major items, just a general discussion of his positions. But I don't think we want to get into a debate over our voting records in the Senate. I think we voted about 3,800 times since I've been there, and I can't remember all those votes. But it'll be a good discussion. I'm certain he'll try to help Governor Carter, and I'm certainly going to try to help President Ford.
Senator, do you consider your speech tonight your toughest attack so far on Governor Carter?
Oh, I don't think so. I thought it was rather mild.
Today, President Ford apologized for his remarks about Eastern Europe, and you had defended those remarks earlier. Do you have any changes to make in your earlier statements?
No, I think I said that it was a mistake. I said it a few days ago. So I did say, as he said today, that the hearts and the minds of the people are not dominated, but the government is, and that's quite a difference.
Senator Baker, has the Polish gaffe hurt the Republicans here in Tennessee?
No, I don't think it hurt President Ford in Tennessee. I think that, as a matter of fact, it's not going to hurt in the totality of this campaign. I relate it sort of to, I guess, the inevitable situation that always occurs in a presidential campaign when you say something that doesn't come out quite the way you meant it. I think that Governor Carter did that when he made his ethnic purity remark, and he spent the next few days explaining it, and it went away. And I think the same thing is so with President Ford in this respect, a careful explanation of it, and it'll yield to logic. And I don't think it's the sort of thing that finally decides a presidential election. So I think it was a bump in the road, but not much more than that, and not likely to be determinative.
Thank you very much.
Congressman, Mrs. Duncan, distinguished platform guests, and ladies and gentlemen, you've heard the old story, the fellow who turns that it certainly is a baby, isn't it? And that's sort of the way I feel about John Duncan's introduction. John and I did grow up together in Scott County. I lived in Huntsville, which has a population of 374, and he lived in the suburbs. He lived out on the highway just past the sign where it said resume speed. But we did grow up together. It is my great pleasure to welcome a man who is a distinguished United States Senator, who has a distinguished wife who graces his presence inside here tonight, who is an outstanding and worthy nominee of our party for the Vice Presidency of the United States, who is my friend and for whom I have great affection, the man who's going to be the next Vice President of the United States, Senator Bob Jones. Bob and Elizabeth have traveled around this country campaigning hard, and my friends, I think it's made a difference. I'm not a very good politician, some people say. I don't say that, but other people say that from time to time. But sometimes I claim to be a good prophet, and I'm going to let you in on a little something. Jimmy Carter and others are running around this country claiming that they have a clear margin of victory in October. And, you know, if the Democrats are going to be ahead, October's the time. November's the time when Republicans are supposed to be ahead. But Jimmy Carter and Walter Mondale and others are traveling around with that smug look on their face like they already got the election won. They've just been reading their own magazine articles instead. They haven't been reading the polls or the way people feel in this country. But I claim a little to be a prophet. And I'm going to prophesy for you because what I am about to say, I suspect, is embargoed for release tomorrow. And I always honor that sort of thing. I'm going to predict for you that tomorrow you find in a national poll taken in the United States that President Ford and Jimmy Carter are neck and neck, that they'll run about 2 points apart. And, my friends, that's smaller than the margin of error in polling. So, friends, tonight, here in Blount County, I declare that this election is a brand-new campaign. We're starting from scratch, and Jerry Ford and Bob Dole are going to win by a big margin in this country. Look for those figures tomorrow, about 2% between them. And goodness remember how it looked a little while back when it was 20 points back or 23 points or some such, and Bill Brock and I looked at them and decided not to look anymore. We just decided that was a bad thing to read about, but how far we really have come as Republicans. It's not won yet, and there's still much to be done. And that's why Bob Dole's here. It is my pleasure to invite Senator Dole to come to Tennessee because I think it's important. I think it's symbolic that a representative of our national ticket appear here in Tennessee and campaign for your hearts and minds and for the enthusiasm of Republicans, of Democrats, and Independents. That they signal to this state and to all of the country that Jerry Ford and Bob Dole haven't written off anything. Tennessee, the South, or no place else. And Bob is here to show that tonight. And to signal some other things as well, that is, those things we already know, like it's imperative that we return Bill Brock to the United States Senate. That it's vital that John Duncan not only win, but win with the biggest margin he's ever had in this district. And that our legislative candidates across this state, but particularly here in the richness of Republican East Tennessee, be sent to the legislature in Nashville to guard the bastions against a Democratic administration in 1977. My friends, Bill Brock asked me especially to express his regrets that he could not be here tonight. He's in Murray County in Columbia. But he sent his better half, and I'd lots rather have Muffet here anyway. Muffet, we're delighted you're here, and when you go back, tell Bill that we'd rather have you for any speaking engagement he has any time and that he can take care of someplace else. We're delighted you're here on his behalf. Now, friends, down to the serious part. Somebody asked me tonight at a press conference, or not a press conference, the press was behind ropes, which is better than we sometimes think of them, at the end of ropes. Not often, but sometimes. But they were behind a barricade, and they began asking questions before Dole got here. I went over to the aggregation of cameramen, not because I was anxious to be interviewed, but it was getting chilly, and their lights were warm. And while I was there, somebody said, well, look, Senator says, Bob Dole's coming to Tennessee, and don't you think he's coming down here to heal wounds or to try to make amends and peace for you not being the vice presidential nominee? I said, you know, that's a bunch of absolute nonsense. To begin with, there are no wounds. In the second place, Bob Dole is not only an outstanding nominee for vice president, but I am heart and soul for him. And besides that, we're going to carry Tennessee for him, and he's going to make an historic vice president of the United States. So you're wrong. You're dead wrong. And Tennessee is going to carry for them. And I really mean that, my friends. This is a great man. He was a great man when he was in the House of Representatives. He's been a great United States senator, and he will be truly an historic vice president of the United States. But, my friends, it is further symbolic and important that we have a coming together here of two significant things politically. Lamar Alexander made mention of the fact that this is the most Republican of all the congressional districts in the United States, and that's true, and many of you have heard me celebrate that fact before. And most of you have forgiven me for the repetition, but I take some pride in that since both my father and my mother represented this congressional district and United States House of Representatives. But it is the most Republican congressional district in the United States, and it's never been more ably represented than it is now with John Duncan. But you see, my friends, not only is it an historic, traditional Republican district having elected its first Republican in 1858 with the beginnings of the Republican Party, not only is it a proud bastion of Republicanism, not only is it a loyal and fiercely determined patriotic part of the world and of this country, but it has its mind and its heart set on doing justice to this native son of the most Republican state in the Union. in the state of Kansas. Bob Dole has done many things in his lifetime, among them defend his country, where he was severely wounded and spent 39 months recovering from those wounds. But undaunted in spirit, he continued with his education, with his career in the law and public service, his understanding of the needs and the requirements of the people of this country, the workings and the ways of the Congress, and the necessity for competition for the right to serve. And tonight there is a symbolic coming together of many forces. The attention that this Republican area deserves from a great Republican national ticket, symbolized by this first appearance by a vice presidential nominee in this community. A man who is from the most Republican state in the country to grace this table tonight in the most Republican congressional district in the country. But most of all, my friends, a man who is the embodiment of...
Thank you very much, Howard. I deeply appreciate those remarks, and I now know what Lamar Baker was talking about. I also appreciate, of course, the gifts from the mayor, and I look forward to flying that flag sometime next year at the appropriate place. I also appreciate the sign saying, "Where's Monday?" The last I knew, it was a suburb in Los Angeles, but yeah, there they are. "Where's Mondale?" Yes. Well, I think he's back in Washington studying for the debate. We're going to have a little debate on Friday night. If you're not at the football game or otherwise occupied, please tune in. There'll be no interruptions for commercials, probably no interruptions for anything. Probably nothing, period, but... We've tried to attract more listeners with our debate, so we've chopped off 15 minutes, so it's only 75 minutes long. And that in itself ought to be an inducement to at least turn it on for a few minutes. Now, we're going to have opening statements, so you will not have to worry about either me or Mondale not answering the first question, as Carter did in the last debate, you might recall. He was asked a question and then made an opening statement. So... we didn't think we wanted that to happen, so we're going to have opening statements as a part of our debate. But we're looking forward to it. There was nothing else going on that evening that we could find, and we thought we ought to fill in our schedule with something. So I'm glad to be there. I'm glad to be in Blount County because I want to make some blunt remarks. I think I was headed for this county a couple of years ago, wasn't I? And that we flew around in an airplane. Everybody paid $25. One of the best evenings you ever had. No speeches. Because we couldn't land, and we flew back to Washington. I think, Howard was on board, and John's son, and we had a nice flight. And I apologize for not being able to land, but I'm happy to be here tonight. You know, Howard, I wondered myself in Kansas City what happened because I understood you had to be on somebody's list, and I kept sending out these lists with my name at the top. We sent them all over Kansas City. I sent them to all the hotels, but I forgot to send them to the hotel where the president was, and I assumed that I was probably out of the running. But on the morning of August 19th, we turned on the television, just a matter of habit, at 7 in the morning, and... it said somebody had a hot rumor that they were down to four names. And whoever was selected had to be present by noon to appear with the president for a joint press conference. And so my name was one of the four. And as we were going over the four names, the first was Ann Armstrong. Well, she was clear over in Scotland. And I didn't see how she could get back, so I scratched her off the list and... The next name was Bill Ruckelshaus, and he was up in Tacoma, Washington. And I figured he couldn't get back. Besides, his name was too long for a button, so I scratched him off. Now, that left Senator Baker and Senator Dole, and I told my wife that if they don't go in alphabetical order, I think we've got a chance. And that's sort of... where it was. And after a while, I don't know what Howard was doing. Maybe he didn't listen to that newscast or Joy, but I told Elizabeth, I said, there were a lot of people gathering out in the hallway. And our room was right next to the Connolly suite. And I figured, well, maybe it's going to be Connolly. The newscast was wrong. But I told Elizabeth, I said, go to the door and put your ear to the door and see what you can hear outside. That's illegal in Kansas City if you listen from the outside or inside out. It's the other way that you get in trouble. But she did hear the name Dole mentioned, and we didn't know at that time whether they were making applications for relief or whether they were drinking pineapple juice. But in any event, we knew there was some possibility, and so we, you know, did the various things and stayed away from the phone. But I can confess, when the president called, I accepted before I identified myself, thinking he might have gotten the wrong number since I was so close to the Connolly suite. So that's really how it all happened. And we've been running ever since that time, and running with the help of Howard Baker and Bill Brock and John Duncan and others. And for that, we're very appreciative. For that, we're very grateful. And I can't think of any other state. Well, I guess I put Kansas in that category, who has better representation in the Senate than the great state of Tennessee, with Bill Brock and Howard Baker. And I don't need to tell Howard Baker that I've been one of his longtime supporters. A couple of times that I can remember that were very, very close in the Senate, but not quite close enough for our feeling at the time. And I served in the House with John Duncan, had the pleasure and honor of serving with both Howard's father and mother in the House, and of course didn't really get a chance to know Senator Dirksen as I'd like to have known Senator Dirksen, because he was one of the great figures of all time in politics, in the Republican Party, and in the Senate. And, of course, some say that Bill Brock and I look alike. He's always comes out better looking, but some, we are about the same height, and he's a lot older than I am, but but there is some resemblance. So if the race gets real close, I've offered to work part of Tennessee for him if he'll come to Kansas in 1980 in case this thing doesn't work out on November 2nd. So now, having said all that and covered all the bases, I'm very happy to be here. I mean it very sincerely. I know I'm among friends. For that, I'm very grateful. We've had some very interesting days the past few days. Been interesting for both the Republican Party and the country. For a while, Mr. Carter had been promising us that his campaign had bottomed out. Now, we interpret that to mean that he couldn't get any lower. We thought he'd gotten about as low as he could because of the many, many things he said about President Ford and charges he made and condemnations he made. And after he smeared the blacks and apologized, smeared Governor Wallace and apologized, and smeared President Johnson and apologized, it was reasonable to believe the signals from the Carter camp that he'd really bottomed out, that it was for real. But that turns out to be just one more empty promise. Because Mr. Carter had managed to go a little lower. And you probably haven't had a chance to see it. Maybe wouldn't see it if you had the chance. But the cover of Playboy announces that they have the story on the real Jimmy Carter. But you don't have to read Playboy to discover the real Jimmy Carter. You just have to listen to his accusations, his innuendos, and insults against the President of the United States to learn what Mr. Carter is all about. And I think we've all had enough of it. I've had enough of it. I hope the American people have had enough of it. Mr. Carter's been campaigning as a candidate of sweetness and light, as a man to be trusted, as a man who would never lie to the American people. Now, the real questions of integrity in this campaign have been and will continue to be directed to Mr. Carter. He is interested in other people's campaign contributions, but what do we know about his own? In 1970, Mr. Carter was asked at a press conference about his corporate contributions, but he refused to say which corporations had contributed or how much. Later, he claimed his campaign did not keep complete records in that race. On NBC's Tomorrow Show, he said, and I quote, "Nobody ever made a report of the contributions, and we didn't maintain those records." So that is his story. On the other hand, the accountants who worked on the campaign have a different recollection. Their names are Bill Lynch and Richard Hardin. And their story is that every penny collected was recorded and accounted for. Mr. Hardin said, and I quote, "The contributions were automated. They kept them on a computer, and there were monthly printouts of all contributions." And I might add that Mr. Richard Hardin isn't just any old accountant that Mr. Carter called in to help him back in 1970. Mr. Hardin ran the Department of Human Resources, which Mr. Carter calls, and I quote, "the one thing which I'm most interested and most proud," and which Governor Busby called, the present governor of Georgia, "an organizational nightmare," and which he still hasn't been able to straighten out. And I'm fond of quoting Governor Busby from time to time to straighten out what Carter may have said or Carter may have done when he was governor of the great state of Georgia in his efforts to reorganize the government. But my point is this. Mr. Hardin and Mr. Carter know each other pretty well. And in fact, Mr. Hardin works in Mr. Carter's campaign. Their stories on the 1970 campaign contributions are diametrically opposed to each other. You couldn't be further apart. But since Mr. Hardin was the accountant, maybe his recollection of how the records were handled is more accurate. Or maybe Mr. Hardin and Mr. Carter didn't have time to coordinate their stories. At any rate, since they are handed to each other now, I would urge that Mr. Hardin refresh Mr. Carter's memory, and that one or the other, it doesn't matter which, make public those lists of Mr. Carter's campaign contributions in 1970. And the wonderful thing about this opportunity for Mr. Carter is that it gives him a chance to give substance to his claim that he doesn't owe anybody anything. That may be true, or it may be that he's already paid off whoever he owed. But the public has a right to have the information, and the press has a right to ask, and I trust they will. And I just make this point to stress again and again and again, as we will in the last 3 weeks of this campaign. The fact is that Mr. Carter's whole house of cards is built not on what he tells the people, but on what he refuses to tell them, such as how did he reorganize government, or how would he reorganize government if he's elected president, and how would he reform taxes, and how would he drive the communists out of Eastern Europe. And you can add his corporate contribution to the list of items Mr. Carter is afraid to reveal. And I say very seriously and very accurately that Mr. Carter has accused the president of cheating on his taxes. Let's see if he can make that charge stick. I think we can sum up the tax question very simply. The Carters are millionaires. President Ford is not. Last year, President Ford paid about 42% of his income in taxes. And how much did Mr. Carter pay? He paid about 13%, about 12.8%. Remember when he was caught using what he calls a tax loophole? He said he was a good example of why the tax law should be changed. Well, maybe he is, but that doesn't mean that President Ford is. And let me refresh your recollection on that in case you've forgotten. Because here's a man who stands before poor Americans, working Americans, so-called average Americans, and he bleeds about tax reform, calls it a disgrace, blames it on President Ford, doesn't tell you who's controlled the Congress the past 22 years or 40 out of the last 44 years. He doesn't tell you that in 1975 his tax liability was $58,000 on an income of $127,000. But he didn't pay $58,000. He took $41,000 off his tax for what we call the investment tax credit. I'm for the investment tax credit. I believe it stimulates the economy. I wonder how many of those people Mr. Carter is trying to appeal to and trying to attract to his campaign made $41,000 last year or for the past 2 years or the past 3 years. And I just think there's a bit of hypocrisy there, frankly, when he stands before an audience talking about the rich, talking about corruption and the cheaters and the liars and the distorters, and that our national tax system is a disgrace. And then when you ask him about the loophole, he said, well, this is one reason we ought to reform the tax system. And we ought to keep that in mind the next 3 weeks. And I watched the debate last week. I wasn't totally satisfied myself. I wasn't satisfied with some of Mr. Carter's answers, or Governor Carter's answers. He said that President Ford did not make an accurate statement when President Ford said that Carter had said that he would cut $15 billion from our defense budget. He said it in 1975. He said it first in Savannah, Georgia, at a Rotary meeting. Then he said it in Los Angeles. And it's reported in both those papers. And he did advocate cuts of $15 billion in our defense budget. So he is documented on the East Coast and on the West Coast. And the simple fact is that Mr. Carter did not tell the truth in that debate. But he says he'll never lie to the American people. And this is another interesting story, which apparently only a few folks in Georgia know about. There's a farm up the road from Mr. Carter's plantation. It is called, if I can pronounce it accurately, Canonia. It was established in 1942 as an experiment in racial integration. It attracted its share of violence back in the days when Mr. Carter was honing his ambitions. Mr. Carter's concern for civil rights had not surfaced. It was before the days of black voter registration. And so concern for civil rights had no political value. And Canonia got no support from Mr. Carter. Or at least that is one story. There are two, as there frequently are where Mr. Carter's statements are concerned. What does Mr. Carter say of Canonia? I quote, said, I went there several times in the 50s and 60s. They couldn't get anyone else to shell seed for them, and I did. I went down there a couple of times to talk to Clarence Jordan. I knew Clarence Jordan when we were going through the years of integration. Now, Clarence Jordan was the founder of Canonia. Clarence Jordan's widow still lives on the farm, but she doesn't have the same recollection of Mr. Carter's courage and strength and generosity. And her statement is, and I quote, it does seem kind of bad when a reporter calls here on the basis of Jimmy's having said he used to visit here and knew us. I have to say I'm sorry, but I don't even know the man. I don't even know the man. I never met him. And we've been living on this road for 34 years. People came here from all over the world, but he hasn't come 7 miles. He hasn't come 7 miles. And she talked about those who supported her husband's efforts to bring blacks and whites together and said that no one in the county would help. And to quote Mrs. Jordan, I quote, they would lose their businesses or lose their friends, and that was more important than their Christian beliefs. That was true of most people in the county. And Mr. Carter was no different. Now, I can understand how Mr. Carter might be less than truthful about his campaign contributions, but why would he go out of his way to tell a story about Canonia? And really, when you think about it, why would a man go out of his way to tell the people he won't lie to them? Most of us assume that when a man tells us something, he's telling us the truth. That is a glue of common trust that makes and keeps us human. And sometimes we're disappointed, and sometimes people don't tell the truth. But we don't start out by assuming a man is dishonest. So what quirk of character would make a man feel he had to protest his honesty and say over and over and over again, I will never lie to you. I will never lie to you. There are other kinds of dishonesty, of course. Let me give you an example. Mr. Carter came out of Georgia, virtually unknown to the American people, and with nothing but a disastrous record as the governor of Georgia to support his wild ambition, and I say wild ambition. In order to lend credibility to his candidacy, he has brought into his campaign a number of well-known individuals, some of them with respectable credentials in their fields. It is their presence which lends to Mr. Carter what little substance his campaign has. And we are led to believe that in the unlikely event of his being elected, these advisors, or at least men and women of equal stature, though his inner circle is very short on women, men and women of equal stature would be in responsible positions in his administration. But again, let me go back to a quote from one of the Carter staffers. In Time magazine, we're given a quote from Hamilton Jordan, one of Mr. Carter's two key advisors for 10 years, who says, if, and these are his words, if after the inauguration you find a Vance as Secretary of State, that's Cy Vance, or as the big new Brzezinski as head of national security, then I would say we failed and I'd quit. That's not what's going to happen. You're going to see new faces, new ideas. The government is going to be run by people you never heard of. So any of you who thought Mr. Carter's lack of experience would be set off by some hopeful, hungry Democrat bigwigs he's gotten right now out to front for him, you've been misled again, or the American people have been misled again, or the Democrats have been misled again by Governor Carter. But on this account, it does not seem simply being misled which is troubling. It is rather the prospect of people in key positions in our nation's government whom no one has never heard of. Can a Secretary of State we never heard of help us to keep the peace, deal with Mr. Brezhnev, Mr. Wall in Peking? Can a Secretary of Defense nobody's ever heard of give credibility to this nation's determination to defend its liberty? Do our taxpayers want to send their money to Washington to be played with by people we never heard of? It's bad enough to send it when you know the people.